Dame Hilary Mantel, author of the best-selling Wolf Hall trilogy, has died aged 70, her publisher has confirmed. She won the Booker Prize twice for 2009's Wolf Hall and then in 2012 for Bring Up the Bodies. And both times, she joined me for Read On. In a statement, her publisher said, "We are heartbroken at the death of our beloved author, Dame Hilary Mantel. Our thoughts are with her friends and family, especially her husband, Gerald. This is a devastating loss, and we can only be grateful she left us with such a magnificent body of work." When The Mirror and the Light was published, I put together a small biography for Read On. Since her first novel, Every Day is Mother's Day, published in 1985, until around mid-2009, Hilary Mantel was a relatively unknown author, described as a best-kept secret of literature. Now, although her fiction, short stories and memoirs were themselves award winners, it wasn't until that Booker win catapulted her onto bookshelves all over the world. A rise and rise that continued with her second Booker win, Bring Up the Bodies, in 2012. I first spoke to her in 2009 after her Booker win, and after the RNIB talking book version of Wolf Hall was recorded by Christopher Oxford.
"Stand up straight," Catherine murmurs, "like a princess of England." Braced against the chair back, Mary takes a deep breath. She turns to him, her plain, pinched face, hard as Norfolk's thumbnail. It is early afternoon, very hot. The sun casts against the wall shifting squares of lilac and gold. The shrivelled fields of Windsor are laid out below them. The Thames shrinks from its banks. The Queen speaks in English. "Do you know who this is? This is Master Cromwell, who now writes all the laws."
Wolf Hall is a novel I've been thinking about for a long time, maybe 20-odd years. I've been thinking one of these days I'll get round to Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's minister, is the hero. He's at the centre of court affairs in the very busy decade of the 1530s, when he's Henry's right-hand man. But I take you back to his early life. Thomas Cromwell's background for a courtier was very unusual. He was born in Putney around about 1485. His father, Walter, was a brewer and a blacksmith. He was a violent man. He was a heavy drinker. Around about 15 years old, Thomas Cromwell ran away from home, crossed the Channel, joined the French army, then began on a series of adventures, about which we know startlingly little, except that they took him all over Europe. He came back to England in his late 20s, speaking many languages, and apparently knowing a bit about, well, most of the things you might want to know about. Finance, the cloth trade, commercial law. Went into the service of Cardinal Wolsey, and from there transferred into the King's service and made the most amazing career, rising from his beginnings in the blacksmith's yard to be Earl of Essex.
Hilary Mantel on Wolf Hall. We were talking in 2009, and reviews of the book reflected the politics of the day and had compared Cromwell to Alistair Campbell with an axe.
I think Thomas Cromwell probably had a little bit more subtlety, at least than in our popular picture of Alistair Campbell. I would say the axe was hidden behind his back. But certainly he was a very powerful man. He was a very ruthless man. He wouldn't have been any use to a king like Henry VIII if he'd been any other way. He was also tremendously clever, quite charming, good conversationalist, good company, well-read and interested in everything. Quite an appealing character in many ways, although in popular English history and in the novel, he's often painted as a kind of pantomime villain.
what I noticed from the novel is you may not like the decisions he's making, but you can see why he's making them.
Yes, the point is about this novel, you're standing in his shoes. So you are following him at every step of the twisty-turny political path. And you always have to say, in this situation, what would I do? Would I do any better?
Now, do you think our image of Cromwell has been tainted by the Robert Bolt play A Man for All Seasons?
Definitely. It's been influential as a play and as a film for two generations. It's very good drama, and that's why. As history, of course, it's hugely biased in favour of Thomas More. There's nothing particularly wrong with that, because a novelist or a dramatist really doesn't have to be impartial in the way that a historian has to, but I do think they have to be informed and they have to work on the basis of the facts. They must treat the facts honourably. Now, Bolt's version is highly partisan, but then so is my book. And I thought it's time we had another look at Thomas Cromwell. And my book isn't consciously an attempt to rehabilitate him. I doubt if he should need that. But it's an attempt to walk forward, as I say, imagining that you were in his shoes and seeing the world from his point of view. And from that point of view, Thomas More looks very different from the hero of Robert Bolt's play, who has, after all, not worn too well, because Robert Bolt's Thomas More is really a 1960s liberal, an idea which would have made the real Thomas More turn in his grave.
Now, how would you describe yourself then, as a historian or a novelist?
Oh, very much as a novelist. But I probably take the historical side of my work more seriously than many historical novelists, because for me it's the facts that spring imaginary constructs, that spring metaphor. It's objects, documents, the source material, everything grows out of them, and artifacts like portraits and so on. So I have to have all the basic work in place, and I'll be pretty dogged in pursuing a fact that appears to be missing. But then, of course, we do come up against the gaps, to the great frustration of historians and biographers, as well as novelists. And it's just that I think there comes a point where the biographer, say, has to draw back and say, beyond this, it's mere speculation. But everybody knows that that's part of the novelist's trade. So you can push ahead into those dark areas and try to find out something of that life that we know must be there, but which hasn't come down to us. Cromwell, his public career is very well documented, but his private life, to a large extent, is hidden. And yet, we know that it existed. Like everyone else, there was a personal side to his life. Like everyone else, he was seething with memories and dreams and maybe regrets and hopes for the future. So what the novelist can do on the basis of the fact, speculate about what these hopes and fears and dreams may have been and try and reconstruct a character from the inside.
Now, how long did it take to research this book?
Well, I have been thinking about it, as I explained, for quite a long time. But when I finally decided I was going to do it, and the time had come, I would say about 5 years in the research and writing.
Madam, shall we go on in English or Latin? Your cardinal would ask the same question, as if I were a stranger here. I will say to you, as I said to him, that I was first addressed as Princess of Wales when I was 3 years old. I was 16 when I came here to marry my Lord Arthur. I was a virgin, and 17 when he died.
I was 24 years old when I became Queen of England, and I will say, for the avoidance of doubt, that I am at present aged 46, and still Queen, and by now, I believe, a sort of Englishwoman.
Wolf Hall is the name of the Seymour's house in Wiltshire. It's still there, although nowadays there's a Victorian farmhouse on the site. But Wolf Hall, I liked it, you know, for its metaphorical resonance. In a sense, everywhere that Henry goes is Wolf Hall. He's surrounded by his predatory pack of snapping courtiers. But also Wolf Hall as a real house is the destination point of all the characters. At the very end of the book, Henry is off on his summer holidays, summer progress. He's going to travel across the West Country. And one of the places he's going to visit when he's on his way back to London, he's got 4 or 5 days, early September, and he's going to go to Wolf Hall. And that's how the book ends, with Cromwell writing the itinerary and writing in these words, Wolf Hall. And I like the idea of a book that was always in progress, right till its final two words.
In the convivial days between Christmas and New Year, while the court is feasting and Charles Brandon is in the fens shouting at a door, he is rereading Marsilio of Padua. In the year 1324, Marsilio put to us 42 propositions. When the Feast of the Epiphany is passed, he ambles along to put a few of them to Henry. Some of these propositions the king knows, some are strange to him, some are congenial in his present situation, some have been denounced to him as heresy. It's a morning of brilliant, bone-chilling cold, the wind off the river like a knife in the face. We are breezing in to push our luck.
You see this story? King has 6 wives, kills 2 of them, divorces 2 of them. You couldn't make it up. You absolutely couldn't. People would accuse you of being melodramatic. And yet, these are the facts of English history. So, I think we're brought very close to these people on a human level. Even though the Tudors were very different from us, there is something in common in the psychological setup here. Henry was a very modern man in many ways. He was a great romantic. And in an age of arranged marriages, Henry wanted to be in love with his wives. So when he wanted to get rid of his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, the fact that he'd long ago fallen out of love with her was part of it, I think. And his plan, because he didn't have a son to succeed him, his fellow monarchs sympathised. Even the Pope could have been brought to sympathise. Annulments like that were granted all the time. So Henry's path should have been easy. But he went and fell in love with a totally unsuitable woman. Not the French princess everyone expected him to marry, but Anne Boleyn, the daughter of a mere gentleman, with something of a past, something of a question mark, certainly, hanging over her sexual history. So falling in love was what really complicated Henry's life. Then he fell out of love and developed a great passion for Jane Seymour, who was going to be wife number 3. And in the course of time, a marriage was arranged to Anne of Cleves, whom he couldn't love at all. Of course, the men of his generation didn't understand his hesitation. Why didn't he just hop into bed with the girl and do the business? But Henry wasn't like that. His psychology wasn't set up that way. We've all known, I think, women who are something like Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, in that they're a career wife and they'll hang on to a dead marriage. And we've all known someone like Anne Boleyn, who's the mistress on the make. So even though there's a yawning gap of 500 years, we can still look at the world about us and we can find comparisons. What we have to remember, of course, is that Henry didn't know he was going to have six wives. Even when he was up to wife number five, he didn't know it. So we have to get rid of any idea that these things were preordained and see these people as human beings moving through history with no foresight, only a lot of muddle and misinformation around them. And I think this period of history, because it's so personal, it makes it very human. And also, there's another thing about Henry's reign which is interesting, in that women have been bit players in the English monarchy until now. But suddenly, a woman and her body and what her body can do is centre stage. It's the absolutely vital factor, because what Henry needs and wants more than anything is a son and the woman who will give him a son. And the whole politics of the reign begin to centre around this question of a woman's body.
Now, you mentioned Jane Seymour. You don't portray her as the milksop that she's portrayed as sometimes.
We don't know an awful lot about Jane historically, but what we do know suggests that when the king cast his eye on her, she played her hand very, very coolly indeed. If she'd been intent on reeling him in, and if she'd been planning it for years, she couldn't have done better. So she understood Henry, and I think she understood the power play of the court and how to use it to her advantage. So Jane, simply because we don't know much about her, is often assumed to have been a kind of non-person, a sort of dumb blonde. But the fact is, everything we do know about her suggests that here's a woman with a good wit and a good brain in her head, and the cool courage to exercise it.
And this is interesting. I asked about a sequel, and it seems that Bring Up the Bodies was once going to be called The Mirror and the Light.
There is going to be a sequel. I'm working on it now, or at least I will be when I stop jaunting around the country and doing the post-booker publicity. It's called The Mirror and the Light, and it's going to take Thomas Cromwell to the heights of power through the next 5 years. He's going to see the destruction of Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour become queen, give Henry his longed-for heir, Jane's death, and the disastrous marriage with Anne of Cleves, and Henry's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, on the horizon. There's civil war. There are all sorts of upheavals in the Cromwell household. I can promise that it will just be even more charged with events, if that's possible, than the first book. And I can't wait to be at it, because in some ways I feel as if when I finished Wolf Hall, I left them there with their suitcases packed, ready to hit the road. And I really want to be back there with them.
And she did get back to them in Bring Up the Bodies. And the two planned books became three. The RNIB version of Bring Up the Bodies is once again read by Christopher Oxford.
His children are falling from the sky. He watches from horseback, acres of England stretching behind him. They drop, gilt-winged, each with a blood-filled gaze. Grace Cromwell hovers in thin air. She is silent when she takes her prey, silent as she glides to his fist. But the sounds she makes then, the rustle of feathers, and the creak, the sigh and riffle of pinion, the small cluck-cluck from her throat, these are sounds of recognition, intimate, daughterly, almost disapproving. Her breast is gore-streaked, and flesh clings to her claws.
I spoke to Hilary on the phone, and first of all, I asked her how this moment felt.
The winner of the 2012 Man Booker Prize for Fiction is Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel.
I was
just incredibly surprised. I come to the evening very, very tense, but fully expecting to walk away empty-handed. I suppose everybody thinks, well, you know, I'm not that lucky. I'm not going to win again. You think my life's not like that.
Now, I've heard you say that Bring Up the Bodies was a much harder book to write than Wolf Hall. Was part of that difficulty because the previous book had won the Booker and there was perhaps a little more pressure on you this time?
It was more difficult only in the writing itself. It took more out of me. It was much more intense. It wasn't technically more difficult. It was only difficult in the wear and tear on the emotions. And I have to say, really, when you sit down to write and you're deeply immersed in a project, the last thing you're thinking about is prizes. In my experience, you're only thinking about your material. So I wasn't at any point in writing that book thinking, I wonder how this will do with the Man Booker Prize. I was only concentrating on getting my story told and seeing my characters through to their various end points.
Now, you mentioned there the word intense, and there's certainly a much more intense period of time in this book.
Yes. Wolf Hall is a big, sprawling book, and the action covers 30 years, and even more because it goes back into prehistory, into myth, to look at the myths about how Britain began. But Bring Up the Bodies, which starts where Wolf Hall leaves off in the September of 1535. It covers only a 9-month span, and of that 9 months, the last half of the book covers about 3 weeks as the events lead up to the climax of the execution of Anne Boleyn.
Now, we know it leads up to that execution. Do you think it's strange that everyone knows the ending to this book apart from the characters in the book?
Yes. What I try to do is to put the reader in the same imaginative plane as the characters so that the reader doesn't perceive it as inevitable, but the reader sees the turning points that caused history to work out the way it did.
Now, what do you prefer writing about? The light areas that are well documented in history or the dark areas of these times that we know nothing about?
I suppose with the light areas, then you think, well, a thing may be well documented, but there may be versions of that documentation. There may be gaps in that documentation. There may be documents that should exist but don't exist. You have something to hang on to. But even with an event that appears to be well documented, you're saying, who's telling me this? Why do they want me to believe this? Is there another version told from another point of view? And where are the gaps? And so, in some respects, if you approach all documentation and all of what we refer to as recorded history in that same spirit of scepticism, then in some ways the difference between the light and the dark areas vanishes because what you see is the shadow behind the light. And so there is really nothing I take for granted beyond, you know, those established days in the calendar on which the axe fell. We often know what happened, but it's the why. That's what I'm dealing in. And every why is dappled with both the light and the dark.
Do you think she, Anne Boleyn, sorry, was guilty of adultery?
No, I think she probably wasn't. But that doesn't mean that I see her as a victim. I think it was a fact that she was not a victim. She was a political player, and she was a big player on the political scene, and she went into battle and she lost. I don't think she herself would have liked to be seen as a victim. Having said that, I know that she was living her life against the backdrop of a culture that was misogynistic. it was an easy accusation to fling against a woman and utterly destructive. The idea of a queen who broke her marriage vows, because what you're saying here is a queen who could put an illegitimate child on the throne of England, a queen who could pull the wool over a nation's eyes. Any accusation of that type levelled against Anne came very near the question of national security. There's a very fine line there between adultery and treason. I think that although we will never know, I think the probability was that she was sitting up, but she had created the climate in which that could occur. You cannot imagine how the same mechanism could have been used to destroy Henry's first queen, Catherine of Aragon. It simply couldn't. She was above reproach. That's not to say that it was Anne's fault in any way, but I do think that, you know, she was part of the political scene in which she rose and fell. She was not a doll. She was not a passive victim.
Now, what periods will you cover in the next book, The Mirror and the Light?
I will take the story up probably at that moment when Anne Boleyn's head falls, as Thomas Cromwell and his son and his colleagues are walking away from the scaffold. And I will continue till 1540, till Cromwell's own death on the same scaffold in the Tower of London.
Now, there's definitely only going to be one more book, because you said there was going to be two and then there was three. Do you think there might be a fourth?
No, I think the arc of this one is pretty clear. There is no calamitous event, no central event like the fall of Anne Boleyn. In the first book, everything led to the death of Thomas More. In the second, everything led to the death of Anne Boleyn. In the third, everything leads to the death of Cromwell, which doesn't mean to say it's a story of Cromwell's fall, because it's a story of his rise and rise and rise. But what happens now is that the pattern changes. Instead of working towards one great climax in the action, from now on, every day is more or less a crisis for Cromwell. There are no downtimes. There are no quiet times. There is no prospect of reflection or recollection or ease. He's living in an intensely pressurized environment, watching his enemies grouping, sometimes defeating them, but then finally not defeating them.
And when do you think we'll see the final book?
Well, now, about that, I'm making no predictions. Works of fiction are inherently unpredictable, which is why my one book turned into two and my two into three. But I intend to work on it very hard next year. As far as I can, I'm pushing other commitments aside. Already they are creeping into my diary, things that can't be helped. But I do hope to spend the bulk of that year concentrating, and at the end of it, I will see where I get. I wouldn't like it to be later than 2015.
5 years after it was initially planned, The Mirror and the Light was released. The audiobook is narrated by Ben Miles, who was personally cast by Hilary Mantel.
Once the Queen's head is severed, he walks away. A sharp pang of appetite reminds him that it is time for a second breakfast, or perhaps an early dinner. The morning's circumstances are new, and there are no rules to guide us. The witnesses, who have knelt for the passing of the soul, stand up and put on their hats. Under the hats, their faces are stunned. But then he turns back to say a word of thanks to the executioner. The man has performed his office with style, and though the king is paying him well, it is important to reward good service with encouragement as well as a purse. Having once been a poor man, he knows this from experience. The small body lies on the scaffold where it has fallen, belly down, hands outstretched. It swims in a pool of crimson, the blood seeping between the planks. The Frenchmen, they had sent for the Calais executioner, had picked up the head, swaddled it in linen, then handed it to one of the veiled women who had attended Anne in her last moments. He saw how, as she received the bundle, the woman shuddered from the nape of her neck to her feet. She held it fast, though, and a head is heavier than you expect. Having been on a battlefield, he knows this from experience, too.
A clip from the third in the Wolf Hall trilogy, The Mirror and the Light, by Hilary Mantel, who has passed away, age 70. For more information on the RNIB Library, or anything to do with sight loss, phone the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. And thanks for listening.